I'm Laura Vinroot Poole. For 20 years, I've owned Capital, an internationally recognized specialty store. Capital has never really been about fashion. It's always been about people. What we wore was created to share the meaningful journeys that inspire me. From the designers and friends I meet on the road to the men and women with whom I work each day.
Everybody wants to know her name.
Ruth Runberg is a former buyer at Brown's, Barney's, and here at Capital. I have always been drawn to her love of storytelling and her exquisite taste. She recently founded R. Runberg Curiosities, which brings furniture and accents from around the world to the South. This is episode 4 of our 5-episode capsule in partnership with Garden & Gun. Ruth Runberg, I am so excited to have you here 6 feet away during COVID-19 social distancing. You're nice to break away from homeschooling to be with me this morning.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you for having me. Actually, so excited to be here. I came yesterday and no one was here. And I pulled up and I thought, something feels wrong.
It's so weird, though. Every day I ask my family, I'm like, what day is today? Is it Wednesday or Thursday? And it is like, this sounds so pretentious, but you know when you only know what day it is from whether it's Wednesday in New York Times' food section, Thursday is style section, and you just sort of have to think back to what you read in the morning in the paper.
Well, I can understand that. I have May, who has an actual old school paper calendar on the wall.
It.
And she tells me all the time, Mama, you need a calendar. I'm like, oh, I have a calendar on my phone. She said, no, but you never know what the day is.
I have to say, we know each other in a different way than I've known any other of my podcast guests. I remember when your mother was pregnant with you. Your brother was my first boyfriend, my 4th and 5th grade boyfriend, I think. Your mother is this beautiful, tall, redhead. And I think we were kind of old for our moms to be pregnant, you know, so it was sort of this really weird, I mean, good weird, but really different thing. And it was very memorable to me.
Oh, there are a lot of connections we have for sure.
So you're from Charlotte.
I am.
Tell me about growing up here.
Gosh, growing up in Charlotte was great. It was a different city than it is today in a lot of ways. It was certainly smaller people-wise. And I think the weather in North Carolina, because of where we're situated, makes a big difference in how you live your life. We have 4 distinct seasons, which mm-hmm. is really nice. So I grew up a lot outside because you could be outside. I spent a lot of time riding bikes around the neighborhood, going from backyard to backyard, from trampoline to trampoline. And I had a tree house in the backyard I spent a lot of time in. And
I've thought about you actually a lot during COVID-19 because I think that I've never experienced Charlotte as when we grew up as much as I have during this time, you know?
I totally agree.
It's so weird. I feel like I'm transported to 1977.
I know exactly what you mean, and I've said that to a number of people, particularly at the beginning when we were home, but not quite as mm-hmm. we didn't have the restrictions that were as it just was sort of like be home. It wasn't
right.
Be home and be away from people. And
right.
So all the kids were out riding bikes and neighbors were out walking mm-hmm. and it was just delightful. It occurred to me that it's because we're also scheduled now
yeah.
and we weren't when we were growing up. Maybe you had ballet once a week and, you know, church choir and handbells once a week or something, but you didn't have activities and people were outside, so
yeah.
That's one thing that's really nice, has been really nice about people slowing down and having less to do
mm-hmm.
outside of just being home. And
I think one of the things I've noticed is that, one, I'm not tired, which I think I'm just like constantly tired from my job and trying to just balance, not balance, but like be a wife, be a mother, be a business person, travel, not be jet lagged. I mean, all those things. I feel like I'm tired all the time. And I think it's the first time in 25 years that I've not been tired. And so I listen and I really hear what everybody's saying to me. And I think that that feels really different. And that's pathetic, but it's true, you know? And I think my family has gotten along better than we ever have just because I think I'm really listening to what they're saying.
Well, I guess you're not having to think forward to what you're going to be doing next, or
yeah.
there's just less clutter in your mind. There's less, mm-hmm. less pressure to go, go, go and do. I mean, you maintain an incredible schedule. I think particularly for me, I'm not great at changing gears between being a mom, being a small business owner, all the different things that being a wife, being a friend, being... challenging for me.
You always said you were not a great multitasker. And Perry, my husband says nobody's a good multi. I mean, he said it's not possible to be a great multitasker. It's not fair.
It's very taxing on me. And I feel like I don't do anything well.
Well, you're such a perfectionist, I think. And so I think that you want to do everything the right way. And I think that's hard when you're doing multiple things at once.
Well, I've tried to work on that. Perfectionism is a gift and a curse. It's really a curse, actually. It's not a healthy way to be. But I think that I've tried to be more comfortable as I've gotten older with being messy, mm-hmm. and not letting, what is it, don't let great get in the way of good.
Yeah.
And being a little bit more relaxed about the standards I set for myself. You can't do everything really, really well. Mm-hmm. So I think you have to pick and choose how you spend your time.
I think quarantine's been great for that too. I mean, I've given myself so much more grace than I usually do. I love your parents. You have very creative parents. Tell me how that influenced you.
Oh gosh, they are. They are so creative and they love you.
We do love each other.
My dad is very creative with building and planting, and my mom is also very creative. She could sew anything. She made a lot of my clothes when I was growing up.
She was in the buying program.
She was. She was in a buyer training program in Birmingham.
She's from Alabama.
When she was in her 20s. She's from Alabama.
Yeah.
And she has a great eye. I think I honed my eye for quality early on because I spent many, many hours trailing behind my mom at TJ's and Marshall's and Lohmann's and all her haunts. She could zero in on the find mm-hmm. on a rack back when there were still truly finds.
How awesome Lohmann's was?
Oh my gosh.
That was insane.
She could really zero in on the best piece on the rack that was the highest quality. And
you also had, you have good genes from your Aunt Jane, who has wonderful taste too.
Oh yes, my aunt June.
June, excuse
yeah.
me.
Yeah, I have an Aunt Jane too, actually. My mom's one of six.
Oh, I forgot. She is one of six.
My Aunt June, you have met. She's something else. They broke the mold after her.
And what was her style like? Tell me about her.
Oh gosh, you know, kind of like my mom and my aunt are sort of like yin and yang style style influences, I guess. My mom loved really classic, tailored, beautiful fabric. I've envisioned her in my childhood wearing like a pleated midi skirt and a blazer with shoulder pads and kind of like a Princess Di look. And then my Aunt June was much more fun. I think about my cousins' weddings and what everybody wore, and it was just so different from what you'd see at a wedding in Charlotte where people would be in more tailored clothes and a string of pearls and a black yeah. sheath dress or something. In Birmingham, their weddings, people were in, you know, sequins and paillettes and color, and it felt more bold. And I guess my aunt always wore really bright colors and bright lipstick.
I think we always had that in common because I have my Florida cousins. And we would go visit them, and I think it's the same thing. They're just so other, like so different, and like these goddesses. They're nothing like what you're used to, and they're so inspiring.
Yes, yes, yeah. My Alabama family always felt kind of sophisticated, and
they smoked and stuff like that.
Yes, yeah. And cussed. And yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Sorry to call y'all out if you're listening. Growing up, I was definitely influenced by both. And, you know, my mom also, I'll say, was really good about underscoring the need to be appropriate and be respectful and to make sure that you thought about what you're going to and that yeah. what you're wearing is is going to be the right thing. And
the right of the audience. I mean, right. Appropriate.
When in Rome.
I think that you're unusual in fashion. You came from finance and moved into fashion, which I don't think that typically happens. You started with an internship at the Stock Exchange, I think.
I did. In college, I got an internship on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, which was awesome. And it was definitely a different time. It was sort of the end of an era at the Stock Exchange then because people were still on the floor. Humans were still on the floor using the traditional kind of hand signals and shouting.
That's so cool.
That was an amazing experience.
And what did you think about it?
I loved it.
What did you wear?
Well, for the Stock Exchange, women were required to have their legs covered if you were on the floor, and you had to have closed-toed shoes. And so if you wore...
And that was just because of, like, danger of the ticker tapes or, like, what?
You know, I don't know. I don't know. I don't think it was a safety thing. I don't know if it was a decorum thing. But yet another way that it was kind of the end of an era. Because this was, let's see, 2000, I guess. Is that right? Yeah, I wore, like, skirt suits and with, like, a collared blouse underneath it. And there was not a lot of flair to it. But it was a great experience being in New York, and I thought New York was fascinating because I think you'll attest, growing up in Charlotte, that we grew up in a place that was fairly non-ostentatious.
Yes.
So it was kind of a drive the Volvo till it dies kind of a place.
Or the Buick, for sure.
Or the Buick. To be in New York, I was just wide-eyed at the consumption.
Flash.
And, right, all the... and glamour. I mean, it felt glamorous to me, which is something I've always yearned for and kind of been attracted to, a kind of a sense of glamour or sophistication.
It's the Alabama sequence.
It is. I was always chasing Alabama. I found Alabama in New York.
I love it.
One thing I did that summer, I took the opportunity while in New York, and particularly because I had market hours. So when the markets closed, I was off.
Right.
So I reached out to various alums who were living in New York, who were in the finance industry, and asked them if I could come meet with them and just talk to them about what they do, just to learn about what different jobs were available. And so I met with a woman who worked for J.P. Morgan, and she covered retail companies in investment banking. And she put this pitch book in front of me that was all about, I think it was a pashmina company, actually, a shawls company. And it was the first time I had ever seen kind of this meeting of worlds of the business side of fashion, that this meeting of worlds that I loved and was interested in. And so there was consumer psychology, and there was thinking about colors and fabrics, and then, but it was all bundled in this financial framework. And I thought, gosh, this is exactly what I should do. I should go into investment banking and I'll cover retail companies. I applied to banks and got a job at Morgan Stanley, and started that following summer, and was placed in the real estate group. And that was fun. We had a real estate fund, and I actually did pitch a deal to do something with Prada's debt, because everybody else in the morning would sit in our cube and they'd have the Wall Street Journal open.
Right. You have Women's Wear Daily.
And I have Women's Wear Daily.
And from there, you went to Barney's. How did that happen?
The analyst commitment was a 2-year commitment. And I was trying to think about if I wanted to stay on for a third year or if I wanted to do something else. Ultimately, I decided that I wanted to work actually for a company that was in that industry as opposed to analyzing the numbers generated by those companies. My mom actually suggested that she reached out to your mom and asked if you had any recommendations. And you put me in touch with Elizabeth.
Elizabeth von der Goltz.
Yes.
Who's the buying director of Net-a-Porter now.
Yes.
But was it Barney's at the time, I think?
Well, at the time, she was on a break.
Ah, okay.
She
was in California.
She was in L.A. and she had been in the buying offices at
Bendel's
and Barney's at that point. It changed the whole path of my career, one. So thank you, Judy. Thank you, Sylvia. Thank you, Laura. Thank you, Elizabeth. And I talked with Elizabeth about what she did, and she was describing what it meant to be a buyer. And when I listened to her talk about it, I thought, this is exactly the job for me. And so I started trying to get my foot in the door at one of the department stores in New York. Mm-hmm. And that was more challenging than I had anticipated.
Huh. Because you hadn't had any retail experience?
I don't know. I wonder if... I had a different background from most of the backgrounds of people coming into the buying programs, I think. And I'm sure they thought I was a nerd, you know. Like, who's this banking kid, you know, trying to... But I gave notice at Morgan Stanley, and I had, I don't know, I think I had a month. And I called Barney's every day for a month and left a voicemail with the HR department.
I love it.
I showed up at Barney's at the HR, and no one would meet with me. I just was baffled. I could not get my foot in the door. And my very last day at Morgan Stanley, I got a call from a woman in the HR department who said, there's a position available. Could you be here Monday to interview? And I said, absolutely. I hung up the phone and spun around in my cubicle to my cube mates and said, guys, Barney's called back. I've got an interview. They said, what's the job? I said, I have no idea.
Do you remember what you wore?
Oh, gosh. Most of my fashion all came from vintage shops.
Yeah.
So I had a Whiting and Davis kind of chain mesh bag that I carried. It was white. I carried that for my follow-up interview with Judy Collinson, the woman who I ended up working for. She was the GMM of the women's buying office at the time at Barney's. And I was kind of insecure about it because I thought, gosh, I don't have a real designer handbag that I'm carrying in, you know.
And I'm sure that was the first thing that she commented on about how much she loved it.
I sat down and she said, I collect Whiting and Davis handbags. And I thought, oh my gosh.
This is going to work.
Thank goodness.
So you went on to work at the most iconic retailers in the world, really. Barney's, Saks, Brown's. What was your favorite role, and what was the one that provided the most growth?
Oh, gosh. Well, each role was so different. Barney's was formative for me because I started. And when I started, I was the administrative assistant to Judy, who's the head of the buying office. So I was the floor secretary. So
I bet you were really good at that. Seriously.
I brought a lot of investment banking intensity to my administrative assistant job. But I can tell you the bankers kind of looked at me like, you're leaving investment banking to be a secretary at a department store? And I was like, that's right.
Read it and weep, baby.
They're like, okay, maybe you better go.
Right.
It was a really neat way to start, and kind of an unorthodox beginning to starting in a buying career.
Yeah.
Because typically you would start as an assistant buyer.
Right.
And I started out as the assistant to the head. I got to know all the buyers on the floor because I was always taking memos to them or picking things up or setting up meetings for them. I met all the people, all the senior fashion industry people who would come in to have meetings with Judy.
All the designers, I'm sure.
All the designers and all the CEOs. I'd spend a day, you know, unjamming printers and changing toner cartridges and running memos, but then I'd answer her phone and I'd get to talk to, you know, the CEO of Prada.
Right.
And that'd be like all I needed for the whole day. I would say, oh my gosh, I've got the most glamorous job.
What an amazing time to be there, especially in light of what's happened.
It was an amazing time.
Yeah. Most creative time.
It was kind of, again, the end of another era as Net-a-Porter had just started online selling. Mm-hmm. And so Barney's and some of the other department stores were scrambling to get a website up. And so that was one of my first big responsibilities, was to kind of organize all the inputs for all the different items to go onto the website.
Wow.
And I'll never forget, I went into Judy's office one day and said, Judy, and keep in mind, I was like staying until like 8 o'clock, you know, everybody else left at, you know, 6:30. And I was always the last person there. I took my job very seriously. Anyway, I went into Judy's office and I said, Judy, so I just wanted to let you know that I got all of the Leroy things updated in the system. And she kind of looked over it. She wore these horn-rimmed kind of glasses, and she sort of slid them down her nose and looked up at me. She had this blonde bob. And she said, Ruth, she said, it's not Leroy, it's Loa. And I started laughing. And I thought, Leroy. That sounds a lot better than Leroy. I mean, L-E-R-O-Y. Where I'm from, you'd say Leroy, Leroy, right?
Leroy.
She said, Ruth, it's Leroy. So I signed up for elementary French classes after that.
From Barney's, you moved on to Saks, and your first buying appointment, you don't have to say who the designer was, but I love the story you tell that you were doing the calculations before the appointment to see what the sell-through was.
Is this the one where I was noticing that we had lost money season after season with this?
It was like a negative, it was not a 0% sell-through, it was like a negative 15% sell-through or something. It was something crazy.
Yeah, it was something crazy. And but our buys were planned up or something like
exactly,
that.
Exactly.
So I had these massive spreadsheets filled with like the data. Smallest numbers you've ever seen printed out. I was reading through this multi-page document and trying to understand the business with this one particular partner we had before we went into before I went into the meeting the next day with the senior buyer. It was one of those deals where I was like, so I was trying to move the decimal over two places thinking like, is this a percentage or is it, you know, right. something's not making sense. And so I looked at it and I thought, no, I think this is an error. And I went into the woman I was working with and said, you know, I think I found an error in this. And it just doesn't make sense that we would have had, you know, this poor of a performance.
A 0% sell-through.
And yet we're planned to buy more this season. And she kind of looked at me like, you know, come on.
Get with the program.
You know. And that's the first time anybody said to me, well, we're partners and we expect the designer to share in the loss of the season. And so that was my introduction to margin agreements and the fact that you might have an agreement with a designer at the start of a season and you would say, I expect this season to make X amount in margin. And if we don't, then you'll write me a check or you'll take back unsold inventory or you'll take back unsold inventory and write me a check.
Which how did any designers survive that? I mean, what a crazy, ridiculous.
Well, they're not.
I know. Exactly.
And the department stores aren't either because exactly. What ends up happening is I think when you take the pressure off of a buyer to create a very directed, specific buy with a point of view, which is really, in my opinion, the job of a buyer. When you take the pressure off of them by saying, you know, you're going to have this kind of stopgap where if it doesn't sell, you can send it back. Then all of a sudden, you don't have to be as selective about what you choose.
Yeah.
And so, for example, if you have an entire brand that's on consignment, meaning that anything that doesn't sell gets sent back to the designer, then you're less likely to be discriminating about what you put on your floor because, you know, it's kind of like, well, why not? Just throw it out there, see if it sticks.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, this is the model that's happened across stores across the world. And so have you ever felt like you go in a store in London, it looks just like a different store in New York and everyone's got the same stuff
Simulacra.
And the same.
Yeah.
It's because people aren't being forced to buy with an edit anymore.
Yeah.
And so it makes the shopping experience less magical and less interesting. From a sort of fashion ethics perspective, a lot of inventory is produced that really should never have been produced.
Right.
More inventory is produced than is ever going to sell right now.
Right.
And it's a big problem. The fashion industry is responsible for so much of
waste
and environmental damage in the world right now. If there's anything good to say that maybe we can look back on and say came out of COVID-19, perhaps the fashion model will change a bit.
Let's hope so.
I know that a lot of people in the industry are talking about it more so than ever. What's going to happen to consumerism post-COVID?
You came from Saks to me to work with us in 2007, I think, which is such a, talk about a trajectory, like the height of consumerism to 2008, the end of the world. You created our entire buying program and put in all the systems and controls within you made the department, which was life-changing, business-changing. But also, I think, in dealing with COVID-19, really, I think you and I and the people that went through that at that time, you know, Jenny, Catherine, Nicole, all mm-hmm. of us, I think there's a different resilience. Who knows what will happen through this or when or if this will ever end. But I do think that we survived that. And I feel like I have a totally different perspective than I would have had. I always say I'm grateful for it, but really, really grateful for that experience, no matter how horribly awful and scary and hard it was.
I can see that. Well, and don't you remember?
It was different then also, Ruth, because it was different then because it felt like, honestly, like the luxury industry was the only, we were sort of the only people that were really affected. I don't know. Mm-hmm. That's not true, but.
I know what you mean by that.
We were affected in a different way than everybody else, I guess.
Right. Well, there was such an awareness of.
Conspicuous consumerism.
Conspicuous consumption, which, you know, I think shows the resilience of the industry because what emerged from that sort of avoidance of conspicuous consumption, Phoebe Philo and Celine.
Yeah.
So everything we right. went from, I mean, don't you remember that last season in Paris? I think that while you and I were in Paris, Lehman fell, right?
At First Union did. And Lehman.
I mean, and we were over in Paris and I mean, don't you remember? I mean, first of all, the shoes were like, the platforms were sky high.
The Nicholas Kirkwood, those things that were really like they were like clown shoes. You couldn't walk.
Everything was sky high shoes and
sequins.
Feathers and sequins. And it was the most over the top, decadent kind of
ridiculousness.
Last hurrah that everyone was wearing. I specifically remember in the middle of the day in Paris walking across Place Vendôme with you and seeing people literally dragging furs behind them. And, you know, I look back on that now and think, man, what we were wearing was so decadent and over the top and kind of ushered in a new era of austerity.
Yeah. So, which was so beautiful.
Which was so beautiful and felt so nice. When Phoebe showed that first season, it kind of pushed a reset button and fashion completely changed from one season to the next.
And I do think you're right, the shoes. I mean, remember Lanvin with the ballet flats and then Phoebe with the Vans.
Right.
That was so crazy. And I can remember clients saying, oh, I could never wear a flat. You know, like that just doesn't happen. Right. I don't wear flats, you know?
Isn't it wild? What? And then now everybody's wearing sneakers. It's amazing how it evolved.
We did some fun and crazy things together, and I have such great memories. What are some of your favorite memories? Other than crying and laughing at the, everybody was singing together at the Lanvin show.
Oh my gosh, that's exactly what I was going to say is that Lanvin show. You know, we spend so much time trying to convince people of how much work it is, because it really is. I mean, it's a grueling job. It is a lot of work. Many people start in fashion and don't continue because it's a hard business. And anyone who has spent, you know, longer than a few years in fashion knows how challenging it is. And
you have to be a warrior.
You have to be tough.
Yeah.
But all that being said, it's also glamorous and it's also fun. It's all the things you think it is and more.
Yeah.
I do. I think about that Lanvin show a lot. That was an amazing show. I wish I could remember the song. Do you remember the final song?
Yeah, I do. It was a disco song. It was like a Donna Summer song or something.
I think you're exactly right. It was sort of a soaring strings kind of disco.
Yeah.
And all the final looks came out, and then all the models circled back out again, and then Albert came out and was dancing.
He was dancing, yeah.
And everyone in the audience, in the stands,
arms around each other,
were hugging each other. People were crying.
People were crying.
It was the most emotional. It was beautiful.
Albert at his height was just the most beautiful thing in the world.
It really was.
Yeah.
He was a master. And it was like this moment of the lion lying down with the lamb. I mean, I remember also the Marc Jacobs show when he used to show in the Armory near the Indian restaurant we always went to before.
Oh, yeah, downtown, yeah. And we were waiting for the show. We hung out with Russell Simmons.
Yes. We brown bagged it with Russell.
We did.
Okay, so for everyone listening, there's an amazing Indian restaurant called Bhati in Curry Hill in the Murray Hill area near the Armory. We always planned to eat there before the Marc Jacobs show. And at the time, it was BYOB. The policy at the restaurant
was.
So we would get usually beers from the convenience store across the street. truly in brown bags and take it with us to the Indian restaurant before the show started.
Mark is also notoriously hours and hours late.
Hours late. And so you could pop out and go see if it looked like things were moving along. And if right. not, like come sit back down, have some more naan, have a sip of your beer. And somehow we met Russell Simmons, like in the yeah. convenience store, right?
Yes.
In the bodega.
And hung out with him. And went to the show with
him. We sat on the curb and drank beers in brown bags. I remember the show, maybe the first show after the recession. It was like the spring yeah. after the recession had been in the fall. And it was so ethereal and beautiful and hopeful.
Yeah.
It's amazing how the shows can carry so much emotion.
Well, and there's such a reflection of the times.
Absolutely.
What is great taste to you?
Oh, gosh. To me, taste is just so personal. I think trends are interesting, but what I think is more interesting is how people interpret them and make them their own.
Yeah.
Taste to me is not necessarily, anybody can buy runway look number 17 from head to toe, but what has always been interesting to me is mixing one element of it with something, old and something you've dug out of the back of your closet or your beloved pair of jeans and kind of creating this mashup of things that turns it into your look and your style.
It's been so inspiring to watch you start your business, R. Runberg Curiosities. Will you tell me about the business and why you started it and tell me about it?
I created a business in which I source and sell unusually beautiful treasures for the home. That's everything from furniture to accent pieces to accessories and objects. The curiosities part, really, I know it sounds like I sell, specimens floating in jars or something, but to me, a curiosity is just something that has a story yeah. behind it. And most of what I buy has a really interesting story, whether it's about who made it. Most everything that I carry is made by human hands and was difficult to make, is unusual or rare, hard to find. And most everything is meant to last forever and be kept and cherished to create a home that has layers that really reflect who you are and how you want to feel in your home. Mm. So I started this about a year and a half ago. I wasn't sure how it would go. I'd never bought interiors before. I think by the end of my career in fashion, I had bought everything that you could buy in fashion, from jewelry to shoes to bridal. I was excited to try something new. And I went back for my first market. I went to Maison Objet in Paris, which I'd always wanted to go to, yeah. and even had tickets to go to at one point, and it fell through when I was working at Browns. And it was a situation in which I knew so much about one industry, fashion, that it made me realize how little I knew about another industry.
Yeah.
So as far as the nuts and bolts of how they do business. And
did it translate or?
No, it's very different.
Really?
Even just the pricing. There's no wholesale and retail. There's typically, they talk in terms of discounts and a discount from retail or net. And a lot less regulated than fashion. They don't have as many guidelines in place about pricing or it's a little bit like the Wild Wild West.
We both love jewelry and stones, and especially from Jaipur,
yes.
Indian stones. And I do think there's a little of that in the stones are not graded or rated or whatever, but it's how beautiful is it to you? I don't know how much it is. The value is how much you would pay for it.
Right. I read that in the Lonely Planet guidebook to Morocco a long time ago, something very similar to that. When I went on my first trip to Morocco, they talked about it's so funny, this experience that a lot of people have that they termed Medina rage. So
right.
Medina is the center of the city or where a market is. And I guess people kind of freak out sometimes in Morocco, Western people that go, we tend to want to know the price, like capital T price.
Right.
And there's often a bartering or a negotiating.
Yeah.
That goes back and forth and you do this kind of dance.
And it's expected.
It's expected. That's the way you do business.
Yeah.
And that freaks a lot of people out because people have in their minds that something has a price.
Yeah.
What is it worth? And what I read in The Lonely Planet, God was so wise. And of course, the economist in me loved it. It said, the price of an item is what it's worth to you.
Yeah.
What are you willing to pay for it?
Yeah.
And it sort of emphasized not to second guess yourself in the market. If you bought something and you wonder if you got completely hoodwinked and, you know, you paid way too much, just let it go. Like, it's part of the experience. If you were willing to pay $100 for that rug, then that's what it's worth. It's worth $100. And
I remember we did that in Istanbul together. I mean,
yes.
And you definitely prepared me for it in negotiating jewelry prices. It's not rage, but it's just like anxiety or
something.
Right,
because you're so worried that you're not paying. What is the price? Come on, what's the price?
And
it's like speaking a different language.
Tell me what success will look like for Aaron Berg in the next year.
Oh, wow. Well, Corona has really thrown a kink into things. We had our first big selling event planned in a space outside of a home. So my first few selling events have been in my home. We've moved. You've come. You know, we've moved all of our furniture upstairs and then replaced it with furniture and objects and accessories that you can buy. So it's kind of a shoppable home. And we've invited people we know in our network, and it's grown every time. It's grown to a broader group of people. So it's gotten big enough and it's gotten disruptive enough to my family that it was time to take a space. And so we had plans for this coming week, April 15th, to have an event at the Duke Mansion.
Oh, wow.
Which will happen. It's just going to be postponed, of course. Maybe in June. I've got to work that out. We have really exciting things planned, and I have so much beautiful inventory to share and to show. But for the time being, things are going well.
Yeah, very well, and very, very beautiful. This episode is in partnership with our friends at Garden and Gun. What's your favorite thing about the South? Or your favorite thing about being Southern?
I'd have to say it's just the way that we engage with each other and with other people. Southerners tend to be really tough, but there's also a gentleness and a warmness and an openness that I think is wonderful and really unique. There's a very unique Southern disposition and spirit that's welcoming and kind and hardworking, but with a sense of humor.
And especially our North Carolina state motto, esse quam videre, to be rather than to seem. And I think that to me, for going through fashion with you in Europe and in New York, navigating this industry with you at that time made it very clear kind of who we were and what we believed in. And it's just different.
I agree. You know, you and I used to always laugh because it felt like sometimes the bar was very low to be regarded as the nicest person in fashion.
Yeah, you're like, okay, great.
It was sort of like, really, it's just kind of being normal. But there's a lot of ego and a lot of attitude and a lot of chutzpah and a lot of smoke and mirrors in fashion. And I think you're right that to be rather than to seem means to just come and be yourself. And when you're comfortable with who you are and where you're from and what you're about, and you get to go back to that stable base when you're done with all your travels, I think that's really something.
I do too. Ruth, tell me what you wore to the prom.
Oh gosh, I wore a strapless short dress, which was kind of radical because everyone was wearing long gowns.
Was it Victor Costa?
No. No, it wasn't. It was bronze, sparkly, and it was 1997. So it was kind of like we were moving into that Kate Moss. There was like the Seattle influence
grunge,
and
slip
dresses and, you know, Carolyn Bessette Kennedy. And we were sort of moving into that 90s, or I guess we were moving out of the 90s. Look. And so this was a strapless kind of sheath dress that was above the knee, and it was really thin and kind of straight, but kind of fitted. And yeah, that was it. It had sparkle.
What was the fabric?
It had a oh my gosh, it was actually kind of gross. It was like some kind of Lurex blend, but it was really pretty. It didn't feel great, but it was really pretty. And I had big pearl clip-on earrings that had a pearl like teardrop hanging from them, really chunky.
Yeah.
And I had strappy shoes
That were bronze. Love it.
Mm-hmm. And I had a little clutch that I have to this day that it was beaded. I bought it at one of the department stores in Charlotte. It was, the whole thing was covered in beads, and it was a leopard print.
I love it.
Yeah, it was kind of a radical look.
It sounds really pretty. Thank you. I've loved being with you.
It's been so delightful.
What We Wore is produced by Capital and Balto Creative Media. The original song, Someone So Enchanting, was composed and performed by Britt Drazda.
What We Wore is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network, powered by Ortho Carolina. Find out more at queencitypodcastnetwork.com.